Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. Today on Sunday, August 14th, 2005, I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, though it's not such a beautiful day today. Today on Media Matters, we have a terrific live show coming to you. We'll have Peter Hart from the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, able to cover a broad range of issues about media and politics in our society. So stay tuned today for Media Matters, but first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Phone companies are looking for new ways to generate more money, and they're inventing strange new fees to make it happen, one of which is billing customers for their monthly bill. Recently, MCI began charging a 99-cent paper billing fee in hopes of coaxing people to move their business online. In a similar vein, cell companies Nextel and Verizon only provide their customers with a billing summary. If they'd like an itemized breakdown of their calls and charges, they must pay an additional $2 to $2.50 per month for the privilege. Without an itemized bill, it's much tougher for consumers to prove they've been victims of billing fraud or other scams. Industry watchers suspect these tactics are employed to help companies weed out the least profitable customers, or at the very least, to increase the profit margins on that market segment.
FCC commissioners, both past and present, lament the state of corporate print and broadcast media, and they worry about how the FCC may try to rewrite the rules governing their ownership. A wholesale revision to the ownership rules first put forward in 2003 was struck down as ill-advised by the courts. And FCC staff are already drafting new revisions to how many newspapers, cable systems, broadcast stations, and networks a single company can own. The 2003 proceedings generated a record amount of public comment to the FCC, some 3 million comments filed in all. Current FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein calls that an historic accomplishment.
The Washington power structure, we've really been heard. I'm not just saying that to flatter you. I mean, they're nervous about this, and we got to keep them nervous. I mean, they've got to be afraid that if they take this one on, there's going to be hell to pay.
The groundwork for such a groundswell of public participation was actually laid nearly 40 years earlier by a former commissioner from Iowa named Nicholas Johnson. Johnson served at the FCC from 1966 to 1973 and was one of the first people to single out the mass media as the most politically powerful interest in Washington, D.C.
The BBC is more independent of the British government than NBC is independent of the American government.
During his time at the FCC, Johnson wrote a book called How to Talk Back to Your Television Set, an instructional manual of sorts for everyday people who wanted to engage in broadcast policy issues. He's hopeful that the FCC's second stab at revising the ownership rules won't result in a wholesale lifting of the current system of caps and percentages. Former Commissioner Gloria Tristani, who served from 1997 to 2001, says a repeat of 2003's near disaster can be avoided only so long as the public stays engaged, both at the policy level and directly with media companies, through tactics such as boycotts, informational campaigns, and shareholder resolutions.
And you shame them in every way you can. And you do that for their advertisers, for their shareholders. You need to use and work all those strategies and battle on all fronts.
Last month, the FCC looks set to reopen its inquiry into radio station and broadcast newspaper cross-ownership limits, but the item was pulled off the July agenda at the last minute. For his part, current FCC Commissioner Michael Copps links ownership consolidation to increasing commercial pressures affecting all media, commercial and non-commercial alike, and he thinks it'll take more than one rulemaking to address that concern.
In the final analysis, the bias that bothers me is not so much a liberal bias or a conservative bias, it's the market bias that is driving this whole crazy sense or scene of media consolidation. We're not citizens, we're not consumers, we're the products. You and I are the products that are sold to advertisers. That's what this big media landscape is all about, and that's the bias we got to get at.
Last year, indecency was a very hot topic at the Federal Communications Commission, so much so that the agency issued a record $3.6 million worth of fines for indecent broadcast content and collected more than $5 million in penalties. That's more enforcement than the FCC undertook in the previous 13 years combined, according to the Center for Public Integrity. The whole indecency flap even got the interest of Congress, where a bill is pending that would increase the maximum indecency fine more than tenfold from $32,500 to $500,000. But this year, either broadcast programming cleaned up quick or indecency is no longer a hot-button issue, because in 2005, the FCC hasn't taken any enforcement actions against indecency. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
All right, buenos dias. Welcome back to WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Coming to you live August 14th, 2005. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and this is Media Matters. Our guest today is someone who has, I don't think, been on the show before. I'm not sure, but many of his yes, he has. I'm getting the word from my producer, Andrew Boyle. But many of his compatriots have been in the past years. He comes from the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a group that probably needs no introduction to most of our listeners. And if you don't know about it, it's a group you're going to want to learn about even before you listen to Peter talk on the show today. Our guest is Peter Hart, the activism director at FAIR. Peter also writes for FAIR's monthly magazine, Extra, and he's a co-host and producer of FAIR's syndicated radio show, Counterspin. Peter, welcome to Media Matters.
It's my pleasure.
It's great to have you here. And actually, Extra comes out every 2 months, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
I want to get that. It's out 6 times a year. And as I said, folks who want to learn about FAIR, if they're unaware of it, go to FAIR.org on the web and you'll learn all you need to know about it. Well, let's get right into things. There's so much. You know, I went to the FAIR website just over the weekend to sort of scout out what the big issues you guys are working on, and it's really a feast of riches in one sense, although it's a dreadful scene in the sense that it's quite a condemnation of much of the press coverage in the United States today. But let's start, if we can, with a story that you worked on, I know, Peter, which is the Downing Street memos. And you wrote a piece not too long ago with Julie Holler on it. For listeners who might not be familiar with the Downing Street memos, and it's understandable they might not be, why don't you give some context for it and then assess how the press has covered this issue?
Yeah, you'd have to, if you relied on the mainstream media, you probably wouldn't know much about this. But it's actually a series of memos, probably at this point half a dozen, that came out. They were internal British intelligence memos, kind of the corollary to a cabinet-level meeting with the Bush White House, and these are Tony Blair's intelligence officials, and they were talking about the case primarily that the United States was making for war. And the pull quote, I suppose, that came from the most infamous of the memos was Richard Dearlove, the head of the British Intelligence Service, sort of the British CIA, had just returned from Washington and noticed that there was a perceptible shift, as the notes put it, in the American attitude. Military action in Iraq was just an inevitability, and this is the quote that everyone focused on, the intelligence and facts were being fixed around that policy. So from the British side, going to war meant very little, had very little to do with the UN and inspections and that sort of stuff. It had a lot to do with what the United States wanted to do, and at that point, United States already wanted to go to war. This is July 2002, so this is before we'd been through the drama at the UN and whether or not Saddam would allow the weapons inspectors in. It took weeks for the U.S. media to take this at all seriously, and even then when they did, it was to dismiss it. And I think the attitude among the press corps was, from that moment on, to try to figure out a way to explain how this wasn't news. This isn't something that is peculiar just to this story, but it is nonetheless how they handled this story. And you heard from a lot of reporters who said, you know, it's an interesting memo, but it doesn't tell us anything we didn't know already. which...
Yeah, I mean, if I can interrupt you, I think that is the explanation I've heard almost uniformly from journalists, which is, well, this is old news. We already knew this.
And it's fascinating. You know, you hear people like Andrea Mitchell, NBC diplomatic correspondent, say that. Well, if that were true, and in July of 2002, she knew that the country was going to war, every time she stood in front of the UN with a microphone in her hand and talked about the diplomatic drive to avoid war or to consider an inspections regime, she was being disingenuous, if not outlying. And this is what you can't quite fathom, is that these people can't have it both ways. You can't maintain that everyone knew this, but at the same time, I was doing reporting that suggested that, in fact, war was not an inevitability. So the explanations sort of ring false as soon as you give them a moment's thought. And instead, you, I think, are left with listening to a press corps that's really talking about itself. Because if you take these things seriously, and I think most people do, then you understand that the media were the ones who failed, I think, most seriously in this. If the administration was hell-bent on going to war for those many months, and the media somehow didn't convey that to the public, didn't expose that, then they're at fault. So you have, I think, a story that implicates the media as much as it does the Bush administration. I'm willing to believe the Bush administration wanted to go to war at that time. That's not the news here. The news here is that you have a friendly government saying so, and I think it provides a basis for understanding much of the administration's behavior, all the way up to the Joe Wilson story, where you have the administration lashing out at a critic, at a whistleblower. I think that falls right in line with this idea that going to war was an inevitability, and anything that sounded any kind of dissent from that was going to be silenced.
Now, when the Downing Street memos, Peter Hart, did become known, I think in late April, early May of this year, you know, there has been a movement afoot in this country to try to force politicians to account for them, and force media to some extent to account for these memos and the contents of them, and bring the politicians to bear, the Bush administration particularly, to be responsible for the contents of these memos. As you said, there has not been a great deal of movement in the news media on this issue. Is there any glimmer of hope down the road? Do you think this will get picked up, or is this issue basically going to remain in the margins?
I'm not sure how it would reemerge. I think the only way would be, and we've said this for months, if an American note taker, similar to these British note takers, were to reveal that discussions were going on at that kind of high level inside the Bush White House, where their strategy was made perfectly clear. I think that would certainly thrust it back into the news cycle. But, you know, you've had politicians who, I think, have exercised as much control as they can over the news cycle, and they haven't been very successful. Congressman Conyers, John Conyers, convened hearings on this. And if you've ever talked to John Conyers, he'll tell you that the reason you do these things is because you hope that the media will take note, that you give it this this kind of mainstream credibility to say, look, we're having an official congressional hearing on this, or as official as the Republican majority will allow us, and we hope that this will mean the reporters will come and TV crews will come. Well, in this case, it didn't really work out that way. It did get in the papers, but mostly as something for certain reporters to laugh about, Dana Milbank at the Washington Post being perhaps the most notorious example. So you have, I think, the way that the system works, where politicians can flag items that they hope the media takes seriously, you had that already with this story, and the media class and the political class, I think, have both determined that this is something not worth pursuing much further. So I think it would take, unfortunately, a rather radical change in either the way that media treat newsworthy events, or it would take a radical exposure of something within the White House. And, you know, if you've watched this White House for 5+ years, it's very unlikely that somebody's going to break ranks, but it's still very possible.
You're listening to Peter Hart today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show coming to you over WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our phone lines are open, 333-9455, and the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We're talking right now about the Downing Street memos and the press coverage of it. Peter Hart is the activism director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He's the author of The O'Reilly Factor, Unspinning Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly. He's the co-host and producer of Fox's syndicated radio show Counterspin. Counterspin is carried twice in the Champaign-Urbana area, every Wednesday at 5:30 on our sister community station, WEFT 90.1 FM, and then carried right here on WILL AM Thursday nights at 10:30 p.m. So stay tuned to Counterspin, an excellent show. And Peter does that with Steve Rendell and Janine Jackson, both of whom have been guests on this program in the past as well. Oftentimes, Peter, the Downing Street memos is held up as, you know, this is ancient history. You know, that was way back in 2002, as if, you know, it's like trying to drudge up an explanation for the War of 1812. In fact, though, I think, you know, clearly this is all about the press's ability to keep a government accountable when it wants to go to war. This current government has sort of strained relations with a number of other countries around the world, and you know, there's some sense that military action might eventually be forthcoming. What lessons do you think our news media have learned from the build-up to the Iraq War and the occupation, or have they learned lessons as the Bush administration mounts its campaign, say, against Iran?
It's always hard to determine what the media are thinking because so much of it happens. So much of that thinking happens away from the television cameras, stays off the news pages, which I think is unfortunate. I think there's a lot of conversations that go on amongst journalists that we are not privy to, but those conversations would help us understand how the news media work. I think the Joe Wilson story is an interesting case.
Though. Yeah, give a little background again for those listeners who might not be familiar with Joe Wilson's
story. Sure. This is the famous 16 words of George Bush's State of the Union address about Saddam Hussein trying to procure uranium from Africa to restart a nuclear weapons program. Joe Wilson, unbeknownst to, I suppose, people in the administration, was watching that and thinking, this is odd because I was tasked by the CIA with going to Niger, checking this out, determining that it was very unlikely that something like this could happen, and it certainly did not happen. So he was concerned that the administration was still touting this as a reason for going to war. And several months later, in a rather celebrated op-ed in the New York Times in 2003, he said, sort of revealed himself, said, this is who I am, and this was my mission, and I think for the integrity of government and for truth and accountability that we should have this debate. And to make a long story short, it appears that the administration decided one way to go after him would be to expose his wife, who was a CIA operative. By almost all accounts, except for a few people on the right, she was working undercover on weapons of mass destruction programs. So this did endanger anyone who probably ever had contact with her over the previous decade or so as she worked overseas. And the lesson, I think, from this was that this administration, at least to some in the media, will lie about things. Of course, when this investigation into who told journalists about Joe Wilson's wife, when that investigation really started up, you heard from the White House that Karl Rove is not involved. And then, of course, months later, it is revealed that he was, in fact, involved. And I think when you watch those briefings, this is the White House briefer talking to mainstream reporters, you can sense an anger among the reporters, people you see on the news every night who don't appear particularly angry about anything. And I think they were angry because the lie was so obvious that they stood and listened and repeated this lie that Karl Rove allegedly had nothing to do with this. And it was one of those moments where you understood that the press corps is finally getting it, that these people will actually lie to your face. A lot of critics of the White House have said for years that they will mislead and lie. But the media has a much higher bar about these things. And I think they set an unreal standard, and it was finally breached. And so you saw a lot of open anger for the administration, or directed at the administration. I think the media often follow way behind public opinion. Public opinion has turned against the war for the most part. It's been that way for months. And the media are starting to finally open up on that question. I think if you look at the coverage of Cindy Sheehan, the mother whose son was killed in Iraq, who is waiting in Crawford, Texas, to have a face-to-face meeting. Why is that story getting so much attention right now? And the interesting thing about that is
that... So you think a year ago, Cindy Sheehan doesn't get that attention?
No, and she said as much in interviews that, you know, she's been doing this for a year. She's been protesting in front of the White House. As far as I know, there are a lot of reporters in Washington, D.C. None of them, or very few of them, took this seriously. And what you're seeing is kind of a meta coverage of Cindy Sheehan and a lot of the mainstream media where they say, you know, there are a lot of reasons this is important now, but one of them is the fact that we're all in Crawford. The Bush administration doesn't talk to us. We're camped out in this small town in Texas. There's nothing to do. And this story walks up and knocks on our front door. So this is suddenly a big deal. And I think that's true. And I think it's sad and kind of an indictment of the press, that the story has to literally come when nothing else is available to the media before they take it seriously. But I think it does indicate that there is some openness to talk about dissenting perspectives on the war that didn't exist a year ago.
Do you think this will... We've got some callers who are patiently waiting, but I do want to just conclude before we go to the lines. Do you think this will translate to the buildup on the perspective action or whatever it might be toward Iran?
I think it's possible. I think, you know, you'd have to be a pretty gullible reporter to sit and listen to the Bush administration today tell you about a buildup of unconventional arms or weapons of mass destruction and take it at face value. I think it's very unlikely that mainstream reporters will treat those allegations the same way they did the allegations about Iraq. I would hope that lesson is clear enough right now.
We're talking to Peter Hart today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Peter Hart is the Activism Director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the author of The O'Reilly Factor, Unspinning Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly, a book I had the privilege of writing the foreword to, and it's a terrific book. I urge you to read it if you're interested in that topic. And he's also the co-host and producer of Fair's syndicated radio show Counterspin, which can be heard locally on WEFT, the local community station, 5:30s Wednesday, 90.1 FM, or right here on WILL AM at 10:30 p.m. on Thursday nights. Let's go to the phone lines now where we've had a few people waiting very patiently. Line 4, Indiana, you're on the air with Peter Hart.
Hello. I'd like for you to sort of tease out the thing of the reporters saying to themselves, well, we all know this information about the inevitability of the war, and so we're not going to report it. It's almost smacks some kind of a different kind of elitism that, well, it's not news to us, so there's no reason to report it to the rest of us. It really concerns me that those kind of decisions are made by particularly somebody from the Washington Post. You know, that I found that fact rather astounding. I just hope you could spread it out a little bit more.
All right. Well, thank you very much, caller. Peter, do you have anything more to add to your comments on that?
No, I think he makes a good point, though, that there is an elitism involved in that. You know, there are different rules for different occasions among the media. If something needs to be repeated 1,000 times and it's a bit of relatively trivial information, we'll hear it over and over again.
Like what?
Any kind of silly Michael Jackson-related story, I think there's no, or Natalie Holloway being the more current example, I suppose, there's no reason for the media to stop retelling and retelling that story. Even on very important stories, or stories that seem important about the UN oil for food scandal, for example, we'll go over that story again and again because it serves some particular interest. This is a story where, because reporters suggest to their readers or to their viewers that was implied in some of their coverage in the build-up to war, that therefore there's nothing new in it. And of course, you know, any reader, any viewer, I think any citizen understands that when you have an official document that verifies some suspicions that people had about how this White House works, it's of enormous importance. You've sort of caught somebody red-handed writing it down. Not only that, someone great risk to their career decides to leak it to the media because they think it's important for people to know this, and for reporters to say, you know what, I think we kind of covered that ground already, the Bob Woodward book, that sort of covered it, or Paul O'Neill's book, that sort of covered it. I think it's just so shocking, but it does smack of, as the caller suggested, a kind of elitism that at this point in the day, Beltway reporters, we know that they kind of fudged on this. Well, if they did, and if you know it, how come you didn't say it over and over again?
Well, you know, Peter, as Fair has written about on many occasions, and I've written about, and many other media critics and observers have commented, usually the way this gets made into stories, if someone in power does push it, if there's an official source, political leader who wants to push the Downing Street memos and make it a story, it sort of forces the journalist to take it seriously. In this case, as you've pointed out, we've got the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers, who's called hearings, has organized a petition on it, and has support of other backbenchers largely in the U.S. Congress. Yet they've had no success. I mean, would it require the entirety of the leadership of the Democratic Party to go on a hunger strike? What would it take to make this a credible issue?
You know, it works in different ways, and it's still a mystery. But you look at the media activism, for example. Several different websites were set up, and the point of these efforts, and Fair contributed to this as well, was to just pummel home to the media that we think this is an important story. So you have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of MoveOn activists, and people, I think, of all political stripes saying, you know, whatever you feel about the war, I think this is a big deal. And you started seeing media coverage of that activism. We know at the Washington Post, for example, their media critic did a story about it. We know that some of the reporters were angry at getting so much email. Michael Kinsley at the LA Times wrote, I think, two, maybe three columns about getting too many emails telling him to take this story seriously. So you do have a sense that that kind of activism actually does open up a little bit of space in the mainstream. But, you know, in the political establishment, I think it would require, maybe not a hunger strike, but it would require the Democratic Party as the opposition speaking in one voice consistently about this. But they're always going to be at a disadvantage when it comes to getting press attention. It's just a feature of, I think, modern political life. It's an unfortunate one, but one nonetheless.
Is it, though? I mean, I'm not doubting it, but I'm just, is it a level playing field? I mean, I just happen to wonder if, you know, when Bill Clinton was in the White House then someone would allege that they had, you know, got a hickey from Bill Clinton in junior high school. It seemed like, you know, that became a big news story. You know, is it a level playing field?
Not at all. I really do believe, you know, against your better hopes for a democracy, that the Republican Party does have the ability to put things on the news agenda in a way that the Democrats don't. And I don't think it has to do with them being more clever with PR. I think, you know, there's an interesting story this weekend by Dana Milbank in the Washington Post, and it's about this NARAL ad that they've now pulled about John Roberts, and it compares how the right and the Democratic Party behave. The Republicans will say, Max Cleland, he's a little bit like a terrorist. He's a little bit like Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. They'll do that to win an election. They'll pull out the Swift Boat ads. They'll do that to win an election. Doesn't matter that they're false. They won't break ranks and criticize their own, and they'll enjoy relatively friendly media attention. The Democratic Party doesn't do that, and I don't think they could do that. I think there's a different set of rules for the Democrats than there are for Republicans, and that is, I think, just a fact of media life right now, and it's one that helps to shift the political discussion even further to the right.
Our guest, Peter Hart, today, Media Matters, and I, we will get back to the phone lines. There are lines open, 333-9455, the toll-free number, which is open, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the lines right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Yes, thanks for your work through the years. I wanted to mention that the first time I saw Cindy Sheehan was actually at the Downing Street hearings by the aforementioned representative, and she was quite eloquent there, and I think she has at least some opportunity to push this out. And I think one of the important things to note is that we need to talk about it in the right way. One of the other, I think the more important thing in the Downing Street memo was that the bombing had already begun, the war had already begun in August, before there were any votes, before there was a visit to the UN, that there was an acceleration of the air war, which is why there wasn't an air war later. And that is the what people are calling the impeachable part of the revelation. And there's been very little discussion of that. I wanted to mention Judy Miller. They changed the character of her incarceration to open it to a possible criminal impact. And I applaud Fair for being skeptical of her, unself-serving diligence at an early stage. It's one of the few places I heard it, actually. There's a great chance, people are saying, that she is protecting her own role in spinning this story. She had a lot invested in the story of uranium and generally the nuclear case. So I wanted you to talk about that. But the reason I really first started to call was to talk about Justice Sunday a little bit. I don't know how much Fair has done systematically on studying religious broadcasting, but this event this afternoon with Tom DeLay being the highest legislator involved in Justice Sunday seems to warrant a little discussion, and I think it's actually part of the whole noise machine that's constructing the kind of opinion that allows for people to believe what's been demonstratedly not true for such a long time. I appreciate that effort. I'm sure the lines have filled up. I'll just hang up and listen.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, Peter?
That's a lot of different issues. We haven't done much on Justice Sunday, but I think it points to something that people have been studying for goodness knows how long, but it's this rise of a parallel right-wing media universe that, in fact, I think has come to be incorporated in the mainstream media dialogue. So some of the ideas that are generated within that system, intelligent design, for example, become, I think, crafted very carefully to be digestible in the mainstream media, and suddenly there is a respectable or semi-respectable debate about evolution presented, you know, on the cover of Time magazine or in countless mainstream media outlets. So I think the point of things like Justice Sunday is not just to rally the faithful, it is also to, I think, codify and clarify talking points and issues that will then spill over into the mainstream media. On the case of Judy Miller,
and maybe if you, again, to put you in this position, Peter, if you give a little background on Judy Miller for listeners who might not be familiar with
her
case.
Sure. You know, and this is, you know, there's several different Judy Miller stories. The first thing to know is that Judy Miller was the primary author of most of the stories about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq in the New York Times that proved themselves to be untrue.
These were stories that indicated that Iraq did have a vast supply of weapons of mass destruction, was poised to use them, gave credibility to the Bush administration claims.
Sure. You know, you look at the aluminum tube story, for example, about a uranium enrichment program that was co-authored by Judy Miller. Her primary method, I suppose, was to use the words of defectors and anonymous sources who apparently were involved in Iraq's weapons programs and use them as experts to flesh out this case. Some of the comments now at this point seem rather absurd. She had sources who were telling her that the entire country was one big WMD storage facility. These were the kinds of stories that you were seeing on a regular basis in the New York Times in the run-up to war. Judy Miller, of course, then became more well-known through this investigation into the leak of Joe Wilson's name, or Joe Wilson's wife's name and mm-hmm. her identity. And Judy Miller has decided not to testify in front of the special prosecutor and has gone to jail instead, citing, I think, a pretty familiar argument that protecting your sources is something that all journalists must do. And there is some skepticism about what her role was in that story. Some people are asking, was she involved in spreading the story more than being a recipient of that information? No one really knows. She's not speaking about this. She's not writing about it, obviously, and she's not testifying. It seems likely that people knew who she spoke to in the first place. It seems likely that they may know everything that is indeed knowable about these conversations. So it's a real curious situation that she's put herself in. The Times and most of the mainstream media have rallied to her defense. But we've been a bit more skeptical publicly about the need not to testify in a case like this. These are ethical decisions for reporters that are always enormously challenging, enormously difficult. But you have one here where you're not dealing with a traditional whistleblower, someone who's saying, hey, the government is doing A, B, and C. I work in that government, and I need to reveal this to the public because the public needs to know about this kind of misconduct. This is a situation where someone in the government was doing almost the opposite. Hey, there's a whistleblower out there. Here's some damaging information about him and his family. And in a situation like that, I think you can make an ethical decision as a reporter to say, you know what, I'm not going to participate in a smear against a government critic organized by an office of the government. So Judy Miller is in, a rather peculiar position, and most people await her eventual explanation of what she talked about and why she decided not to testify. And in the absence of that, there are a lot of rumors that go around, most of them probably not worth repeating because they're completely unverifiable. But there are good questions to ask about her situation.
We're talking to Peter Hart today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. This is a live show, so please do call in if you have questions or comments. The number 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Peter Hart is Activism Director at FAIR. He's the author of the book, The O'Reilly Factor, Unspinning Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly, and he is a co-host and producer of the program Counterspin, which is aired here on WILL AM 1030 p.m. on Thursday nights and also on WEFT 90.1 FM, the local community station, at 5:30 on Wednesdays. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Bridgeport, Illinois, you're on the air with Peter Hart.
I think you're... host there, well, you'd be the host. I think the fellow that's speaking there, Peter, I think he has everything completely turned around. I really do. And another thing, you never hear nothing out of George Bush. He's always criticized and criticized and criticized. You never hear him getting back and rebuking anybody. And then, on the other hand, we're in a war right now, and all of these comments that made, such as this, just plays into the hands of the terrorist and our boys over there. So I think you ought to kind of put that in your pipe and smoke it, okay?
All right, well, thank you very much, caller. Peter, this gets to a comment that's on your website that Bill O'Reilly made, getting to the caller's last comment, that criticism of the president, or certainly of the war, borders on being a traitor.
He was actually speaking about Cindy Sheehan again, whose son was killed in the Iraq War. And O'Reilly was more worried about what other military families were going to feel like because he suggests that they would consider those comments treasonous. And O'Reilly does too himself. He can put that idea in other people's mouths. But he was saying very early on, the beginning of the war, people who criticized the war had a right to criticize it, but now they need to shut up. As far as I know, he hasn't changed his position on dissent. So there is, I think, a tendency and a growing one on the right to not tolerate criticism of the president, criticism of the war, criticism of foreign policy. And you've seen this most clearly in the way they've treated this woman who lost her son. The caricature of the right is one that supports the troops no matter what. Here we have figures on the right who are more than willing to I think, viciously slam a military mother. Michelle Malkin, an unfortunately popular right-wing pundit, went on the O'Reilly Factor and said, you know, I don't think her son would approve of her behavior, which is a really monstrous thing to say. And I think in any sane media culture, things like that would be rejected and pushed out to the fringes. But these are the people who, unfortunately, have control of the microphones and the cameras, and this is the kind of conversation they're willing to promote.
Well, Peter, I think the caller really, if I can paraphrase, the balance of his call is premised on the idea that our media are not in cahoots with those in power, but rather far too adversarial towards the administration in the war, and it's reminiscent or echoing the common refrain that we have a liberal news media that's to the left of the American people, that's sort of anti-American and anti-war. I suspect you've heard this argument before. What do you make of that argument? You must hear it, in fact, quite frequently.
I think it's a tactical argument by the right. I think it's used to rally the faithful who don't like to hear anything critical of their president or their party. And I think it's also used to kind of bully the press corps. And it's been used with great success. So that's why they keep doing it, despite the fact that there's nothing to suggest that that's the kind of media we have. And it's pretty easy to challenge these ideas and to document them. You look at something like when we looked at the 2 weeks of coverage on the networks around Colin Powell's address at the UN, February 2003.
Which was instrumental in sort of laying the foundation for the war.
Absolutely. The most important moment for the administration in making its case for the war. 393 people are on the network newscast to talk about Iraq and going to war. Three of them are opposed to the war. The rest are an array of official sources, promoters of the war, military officials, that sort of thing. This is not a media system that was really holding the administration's feet to the fire. Those things do change, of course. And if you were to do a similar study now, you would find something a little bit different, I think. There are more Democrats who are willing to speak out against the administration's Iraq policy or its foreign policy. So you do have, I think, a media that all too often reflects the state of elite debate. And when elite debate is essentially shut down, when the elites are in agreement on something, whether it's trade policy or Iraq policy, the media reflect that, and in turn they reflect a lack of debate. And I think that's really harmful to democracy, whether you're talking about NAFTA or CAFTA or the World Trade Organization, or whether you're talking about going to war. And it's been one of the projects of FAIR and like-minded groups over the years, is to expand that Rolodex of sources and officials and experts and spokespeople that the media rely on to have a more robust and genuine debate, which would serve, I think, democratic interests more than the current one.
We're talking to Peter Hart, the activist director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR. You can find out more about FAIR on the web at www.fair.org. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Peter Hart.
Hello. In this week, it's been discussed that the position of news anchors is going to change. And I wanted to ask if, first of all, if you agree with that. And second, if you do, how much of that may be due to the types of people who are going into media journalism these days and what their priorities are as opposed to what they may have been in the past? And second, is the diminished power of the news anchor going to allow, I think, more corporate control of news priorities because there's no longer an important popular figurehead who can say, you know, I think this news story is important, it should have priority, we should be covering it. Thank you.
Thank you. Peter? And
yeah,
this is, of course, on the heels of the death of Peter Jennings in the last week.
Certainly. You know, I don't think the anchor position makes all that big a difference. I think other media systems get by just fine without star anchors. If anything, if you look at the health of a single media conglomerate, if anything, anchors tend to be rather overpaid for what they do. If you watch the BBC World News, which is unfortunately what a lot of Americans do on their public television systems because it's a serious newscast as opposed to the ones that they might watch on the networks, you understand that the news reader is someone who's just there to read the copy that's written by other journalists, and you speak to journalists in the field, you interview guests, but it isn't the same kind of culture that we have in this country. So I don't think it'll have a huge impact on the quality of news. What would be refreshing and probably impossible under the current state of media ownership would be to put that kind of money into beefing up a news organization behind the scenes, adding more reporters, producers, researchers, the things that really, I think, add up to a great newscast. If you could do that with the $8 or $10 million salary that an anchor gets, I think that would be a fantastic thing. You also, you know, as media corporations flee poverty, you have to look at the business pages and remind yourself that these are people who receive amazing salaries. I remember looking at Sumner Redstone from Viacom, you know, just the bonus that he gets is in the tens of millions of dollars. At the same time, they're saying that we've got to cut the news operation to the bone because we can't afford to sink money into this losing proposition of an evening newscast. I think the public would rally around the idea of a news corporation saying, you know what, we're going to put resources in this. It might not be a familiar Walter Cronkite-style newscast, but it's going to be a quality newscast. Something like that, I think, is a pipe dream, given the corporate constraints that exist in the media. But I think it would be a refreshing change of pace for people. Things are changing in the media business all the time, and I suppose now is a more profound shift, or potentially profound shift, than in many other periods. But I think at the bottom line is that the news anchor was not necessarily someone who could stand up and say, we're going to do this story, we're not going to do this story. They were people who made it to the top by looking good, by sounding good, not necessarily by their skills as journalists, per se. Jennings, I have to say, is probably an exception, and I think a lot of people felt that way. He had a lot of experience as a foreign reporter, and I suppose earned the chair that he had there, and he was very involved in writing copy. But one thing that's always important to know about how the media work is that the forces that I think filter out certain stories of the news and keep the news on a relatively narrow track are forces that are much more powerful than one person sitting at the anchor desk. I think the rules are set in place by people who make much more money and who have very different agendas.
Peter Hart from FAIR, we've got a couple callers patiently waiting, but before we get to them, I want to talk about a piece you wrote recently, which is on the paucity of labor coverage in our news media. You were especially talking about on television news, in view of the fact that we've had a major crisis in the labor movement, typified by the breaking up of the AFL-CIO this summer. Maybe talk a little bit about that and what that says about our journalism today.
Yeah, it's. I think it's reflective of the idea, popular among a lot of elite journalists, that labor unions just don't matter. They're kind of antiquated, a throwback notion to an era that no longer exists. And I think the reason that we noticed this was an interview that Bill Moyers had done with Chris Matthews on his program, and the topic was something else. But Chris Matthews decided, apropos of nothing, to suggest that you never see a good, articulate labor leader on Sunday morning television. Why is that? Where are those people? And this was particularly ironic to us because Chris Matthews, of course, hosts a Sunday morning chat show. He could have labor leaders on whenever he wants. And the point is that he doesn't. And that when you do see labor coverage, it is, like in the last couple of weeks with the AFL-CIO split, it is when I think something particularly heated happens, when there's an internal dispute or some kind of conflict. Then suddenly reporters remember that this is a beat. We talked to a guest on Counterspin a couple weeks ago about this, and he said, you know, I was there at the AFL-CIO convention, and you had a lot of reporters never been to a labor convention or weren't familiar with these things, and you had to kind of lead them around and explain to them who was who, how this worked, how that worked, because it's just not something that's a part of any news cycle anymore on a sort of mainstream corporate level. Nonetheless, these things continue to happen, and labor has its own, really its own kind of media system that is sort of self-contained, and rarely does that stuff spill over into the mainstream. So you had a lot of reporters covering this because they knew there was going to be a fight, and that was the kind of thing they were there to cover. Now, if it had been an AFL-CIO convention where they were talking regular business, you'd see a story or two.
Now, on the one hand, the coverage of labor has pretty much fallen off the map, and prominent labor leaders who once were everyday names in American popular life 40, 50 years ago, barely known to the vast majority of Americans. That could be just a reflection of the decline in journalism, the lack of resources going to serious journalism. Is that complemented by a similar decline in coverage of business and corporate activity in our news media?
Of course not. You know, the CEOs are still the stars, and there are entire newscasts some of which are on public television, devoted to investment and business. You have an entire section of your newspaper, most likely, that's devoted to the workings of the business class. There's no comparable labor or working class coverage. And it's for a number of reasons. I think most of them political. These would not be readers or viewers or listeners that advertisers would find particularly attractive.
If you're doing a labor section, you mean?
Sure. You know, if you're saying, go to ABC News and tell them you want to pitch them on a working class public affairs show, they'd laugh you out of the room because they'd say, well, first of all, we'd not find any corporations that would want to underwrite this particular project. And second of all, you'd attract the wrong audience. This would not be people that corporate advertisers would want to reach to sell soap and toothpaste to. So you have, I think, a situation where the ownership structure of the media dictates the fact that these stories and these issues are essentially off the table. I don't think, as Chris Matthews suggested in this interview with Bill Moyers, that it's because labor leaders are simply no longer articulate spokespeople. Anyone who's been to a labor convention or knows the local labor scene knows that that's not true.
I can speak from my experience. George Meany had about as much sex appeal as, like, you know, the gray post on the wall. Let's go back to the phone lines if we can. We have two callers who have been very patient. Line two, Urbana, you're on the air with Peter Hart.
Yeah, I just wonder if Mr. Hart would go back to what he was talking to before, where you said that you thought that the what's you know, arrayed against you, fighting against you, is much bigger than you know, just one person, like a anchor. Why I can't understand why no one on the left seems to be willing to go to what seems pretty obvious to me, and that is that this unknown opponent is really the majority. I mean, a lot of people out there want to hear spin, and they don't want to hear harsh truth. And I think I could point to the success of people like O'Reilly, you know, as evidence. And I don't understand why there isn't more talk about that. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. So, yeah, Fox News is just giving the people what they want. So if you don't like O'Reilly, don't blame O'Reilly. Blame the morons who watch O'Reilly.
Yeah, you know, the thing to remember about the success of Fox in particular is that it's a rather small audience. O'Reilly is the king of cable news, which is to say that he can get 2.5 million people to watch his newscast. That's a lot of people. 8 million people will watch one of the network newscasts the same night. So it has to be put in that kind of context. I think the right has developed a skill for, and Fox in particular, for marketing a cable channel to an audience that, frankly, advertisers are not afraid of, and they know that the content on the channel will not upset the powers that be, whether it's elite advertisers or the ownership class. You compare that, say, with Phil Donahue's experience on MSNBC. MSNBC fired him when he was the most popular host on their cable channel. Now, based on business sense, that's a crazy idea. Nobody would do that. But that was a political decision. They were heading toward what seemed to be an inevitable war with Iraq, and MSNBC would be the one cable channel that had a host who was openly challenging the justification for that war. So MSNBC said better to fire him now than to deal with that kind of political reality. So a lot of this, I think, is about ideas that faceless and sometimes nameless owners have about what is saleable and what can be successful.
Like
Bill Moyers' show on
yeah, but
on
let me
CBS,
on behalf of the caller, let me. Do you think the majority of the Americans, or a significant percentage of Americans, is much rather hear about Natalie Holloway and her escapades down in the Caribbean than they would want to hear about the origins of the Iraq War and why we got into it? Something like the Downing Street memo. Is that your sense, and that the our commercial news media are simply responding to the wishes of the American people as they should, and that our complaint should be the American people? I mean, how does that play out?
I think there's always a good rule not to blame the people, because the people are generally more sensible than that. Natalie Holloway is a very big story again on cable news, which is a very small segment of the population. The fact that 2 million people want to follow this in a country of hundreds of millions is not that, I think, is not a lesson that you want to draw. I think the fact of the matter is that
people cannot turn on the kind of coverage that doesn't exist. They can't find this stuff on their dial. They can't find this discussion of the Downing Street memo because it isn't there. So you have no way to test whether or not there's a public appetite for this. And number two, journalism is not supposed to be about the business of responding to the public mood and whatever the public wants. That makes perfect business sense. It's not what journalism is supposed to be about. I think there are values here that collide, commercial values and traditional journalistic values, and more often than not, those commercial values carry the day. And I think we've raised a generation of Americans to believe that that is a sufficient response. Well, that's what the people want. Well, we should demand more from the media than simply telling us comforting stories about this or that. That's not what journalism at its core should be.
We're talking to Peter Hart. We have time for one final caller. Shelbyville, you're on the line with Peter Hart.
Yes, and what you just said, you know, I think part of the reporter's thing is they must get a spin with something interesting. You know, when we talk about Wilson's wife, Carl Rowe's statement, Wilson's wife was fair game. I think that should be repeated every time because every hunter knows exactly what that means. And like the CIA operative, it took $500,000 to $1 million to train her because she was not a regular CIA. And I think we must have true reporting and not news with a spin. And I'll tell you what really worries all of us. Is NPR going to be muzzled? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we only have about a minute or two left, but maybe a few. I know FAIR has done a lot of work, Peter, looking at NPR over the years and its coverage. What's your sense of it?
I think for the most part, NPR suffers from the fact that it too often mimics what's happening in the commercial media, with some exceptions. I think the exceptions are largely in tone. It's a more civil discussion that's going on elsewhere on your radio dial, for sure. I think when you look at the sources, who they're talking to and where they're coming from, it unfortunately mirrors a lot of what is already available in the mainstream media. I think some of this has to do with two things. The threat of losing federal dollars, which is always an issue with public media and points to the deficiency in our system of allowing right-wing Republicans the opportunity to bash public media whenever they get a chance and threaten its funding. And number two, it has to do with the fact that you are trying to develop a independent media outlet that is tethered to these funding concerns. So you do tend to, I think, pull your punches at times because you're worried of awakening this beast who every couple of years trots out and tells the same story. NPR is a socialist network, and we've got to cut the funding, and Bill Moyers is on PBS too often. We've got to do something about that. You're always playing defense in the world of I think, public broadcasting. And that's unfortunate because I think it's an argument that bears little resemblance to what's actually on public broadcasting. Public broadcasting is there to take chances and to, at times, I think, offend people or at least shake them into thinking about things in a different way. And they really can't do that when they live in a political climate that suggests that any false move will bring down the power of Congress, and suddenly the checks will stop being written, and you'll have to find a way to do with a lot less money than you had before.
So Peter Hart, you know what? I hear the band tuning up in the background, and that means that it's the end of the show for us. I want to thank you so much, Peter, for joining us today in Media Matters. Peter Hart, the activism director at FAIR, author of The O'Reilly Factor, unspinning Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly, and co-host and producer of Counterspin, heard here on WILL Thursday nights at 10:30 p.m. Thanks again, Peter. My name is Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, as always, for the terrific work, and I'll be back in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with showers likely and isolated thunderstorms. The high in the mid-70s with north winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the lower 60s and light and variable winds. Tomorrow, decreasing clouds with a high in the lower 80s and light and variable winds. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at WILL.UIUC.EDU. It's 2 p.m. A Prairie Home Companion is next.